Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the Extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. She's covered politics and other news for more than four decades. Today, highlights from my conversation this past Tuesday evening with renowned journalist Judy Woodruff at Hancher Auditorium in Iowa City. Woodruff was invited by the University of Iowa College of Law to be part of their Levitt Lecture Series. The recipient of numerous awards, Woodruff is currently senior correspondent with the PBS NewsHour. For 11 years, she served as its anchor and managing editor. It was such a thrill for me to be asked to interview her on stage. We discussed her latest reporting project, America at a Crossroads, which aims to better understand our country's political divide. Then later in the evening, she also tackled questions from the audience at Hancher Auditorium. Judy and I were welcomed onto the stage by the Dean of the University of Iowa College of Law, Kevin Washburn. And then we began our conversation.
Judy, what a pleasure to be on the stage with you. This is the absolute truth. You are, as I'm sure others will say, an idol of mine. I have looked up to you for decades. And I am not just saying that.
Thank you.
Very often in my career, I get stuck in a particularly difficult guest, and I actually hear myself say, "What would Judy ask?"
That's the highest compliment I think I've ever been paid. Thank you, Ben.
At home, three adult children can attest to this, as can my wife, that it was not known as the PBS NewsHour with Judy Woodruff. It was known as Judy Time. And help with homework can wait until after Judy Time.
I'm sorry for your children.
So, Judy, I wanted to talk mainly to start off with about your exciting new project here. The political landscape in 2024, of course, is unlike we could have imagined just a few years ago. Since January 6th, the U.S. Capitol riot, we have ruminations about civil war. I'm sure the first time I heard someone mention civil war, are you crazy? That's crazy talk. It's become normal to talk about that now for several years. It's clear that the very foundations of our democratic system, including fair elections, are being tested. Your current series, America at a Crossroads, examines the many divisions fracturing the U.S. Let's keep that picture in our heads of being at a crossroads. And maybe there's a right path to the right, to the left, but maybe there are many paths in front of us. First of all, describe where you see us. What is this crossroads about?
I will attempt to answer that, but first I have to say that, yes, I'm a Duke Blue Devil, but thanks to Caitlin Clark, I'm a Hawkeye. Everybody in America is a Hawkeye right now. I have to say that she is simply remarkable, and I know there are many, many remarkable young athletes at this university and other universities, but what she's done to put the light in the eyes of so many young women I see coming along is so exciting. I had to say that. She's simply amazing. Yeah, she really is.
I don't think she has a game tonight. Is she in the audience? Everybody look around.
I'm sure she's got so many better things to do. But how do I see America now? There are gaps in the American story right now. But we are a country that's constantly striving and in the right, and I think striving to do the right thing. We are also a divided country. And of course, the natural question is why? How did we get here? And it's a big question, and we can explore it as we sit here, Ben. But to me, it's several things. It is that we are changing demographically. We're a country of immigrants. We are the Statue of Liberty. We're the country that's welcomed people from everywhere to come here. Now we're arguing about that. We are arguing about education, about what our children should be taught in the schools. We are arguing at our university, at our great colleges and universities over free expression and free speech. We are a country with we're struggling to, frankly, get our arms around technology, around social media, around the changing media that so, I think, too divides us, too much divides us in our views. Our politics is divided. We have a money-driven system that is, I think, way too partisan. Our primaries have become very partisan. In the case of Iowa, you see it in your caucuses. Candidates are now winning because if they're a Republican, they're moving more to the right. If they're a Democrat, they're moving more to the left. And so there are a number of different elements of what's going on right now that is dividing us. Our political leadership is clearly part of the story, but it's not the whole story, and it's something that's been building for some time. We can explore this in our conversation, Ben, but I see a country with so much potential. We've come so far. We've offered so much opportunity. We continue to offer. I mean, I had the gentleman who drove me earlier today from the airport in Cedar Rapids to the hotel here in Iowa City told me that he, where his son goes to college and how proud he is of his son. And I keep hearing these stories of the next generation doing better than the parents' generation. And that's what makes me know that we are somehow going to get through this. But having said that, there's no question we're struggling right now.
Before I ask this next question, Judy, I wanted to get a sense, because we're looking out, we're under fairly bright lights, we can see most of the 1,800 seats here at Hampshire are filled here, but also because I'm a radio guy and I go by what my ears tell me, I wanted to do a little, get a sense of the demographics of our audience by asking our audience to applaud when I mention the election year that you voted in. We're going to kind of travel back through time. I'll start at the beginning of the millennium. We'll start with 2000 and work back. And as you can guess, we'll get fewer and fewer, and we'll find out who are the most senior voters in this crowd. as a way to talk about how our politics have changed. So, clap if you voted in the year 2000, George W. Bush, Gore. What about in 1996, Clinton v. Dole? There was a Texan named Perot in that one as well.
92,
yes. What about going back to the 80s, 1988, George H.W. Bush and Mike Dukakis? Now remember, you need to stop clapping once you're too young to vote, right? So let's go back to 1980, Reagan v. Carter. We're still very strong there. Okay, what about 76, Carter v. Ford? 72, Nixon McGovern. 68, Nixon Humphrey. Okay, now we're starting to thin out. 1964, Johnson Goldwater. Okay, listen, 1960, Kennedy Nixon. 1956, Eisenhower Stevenson. 1952, Eisenhower Stevenson. Wow, dare we go to Truman and Dewey? All right, Judy, we have an acoustic demographic graph of who we have out in our audience.
There are a few people who are as old as I am.
What was your first presidential election as a journalist?
It was 1972. I was a reporter for the CBS station in Atlanta, covering Georgia politics standpoint. It wasn't until 76 when NBC hired me to cover, first of all, local, the southeastern United States, and then presidential politics, that I was able to be on the trail and to cover election night.
During that election cycle that brought a Georgia peanut farmer to the White House in... That,
such an unconventional way, and we were still shocked post-Watergate, weren't we? I mean, that's... What do you remember most about what Jimmy Carter represented in that period, post-Vietnam, post-Watergate?
His saying was, I want an America that's as full of love as the American people. He was reacting to Watergate, frankly, if you will, playing off of Watergate, playing off of this terrible scandal that had shaken Washington, shaken the country, a president forced to resign. And Jimmy Carter's view was, with a big smile, coming out of the South, a Democrat who was a new kind of Democrat, who was not a segregationist, who could...
Who is a born-again Christian.
A born-again Christian who could bring... But think about it, a Democrat from the South, born-again, as you say, born-again Christian, who had on his... The day he was inaugurated as governor of Georgia, said the days of segregation are over in the state of Georgia, which made huge news. I mean, yes, it was 1970, and you would think that, that those days were behind us, but there were still many parts of the South at that point that were not that way. No, NBC sent me to cover, to do a profile of Jimmy Carter, and the first place we came was Iowa, because he was spending, why was he spending a lot of time here? Because his team figured out early on, a year beforehand, that, or 2 years, frankly, that Iowa was the place to be, that if he could do better than expected in Iowa, and sure enough, he came in, you know, ahead of undecided, undeclared, but he spent a month, or I'm sorry, a year, more than a year, staying in people's homes. He may have stayed in the home of somebody in this audience tonight. He would, he and Rosalind and their little cadre of staff went around the state, knocking on doors, going into coffee shops, meeting people, flower shops, shaking hands, and it was retail politics at its finest.
You're listening to a conversation from this past Tuesday evening, March 19th, at Hancher Auditorium in Iowa City, part of the University of Iowa College of Law's Levitt Lecture Series. Back in just a moment with more highlights from the evening. It's River to River from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back with more of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's get back to highlights from a conversation I had with Judy Woodruff, senior correspondent with the PBS NewsHour, recorded on Tuesday evening at Hancher Auditorium. At this point, I asked her when she saw the first warning signs that the political landscape was changing and division in our country was growing.
Well, you know, I trace this, Ben, a lot, so much of the division today that we're all very aware of back to the early 90s. It's not that there, I mean, we've had division in America. As a political reporter, whether it was in Georgia or I moved to Washington in 1977 and I've stayed ever since, I've covered Democrats and Republicans. They've had debates, they've had disagreements. That's not new. In fact, when my husband and I are about to celebrate our 44th wedding anniversary next month, when we, thank you, and he's a journalist, and when we started going out, and then after we were married, we would have people over for dinner, and you would always invite Republicans and Democrats. It was always a mix. We were both reporters. We were interested in getting to know people and talking to people from both parties. That was common. There were more members of Congress at the time who brought their families to Washington. They didn't all rush back home to the district or the state. They did it a fair amount, but it wasn't something you had to do every single weekend. And so families got to know each other. Their children sometimes actually went to school together in the Washington area. The spouses got to know one another. But certainly the members got to know each other because they spent time together. It wasn't frowned on that you were going to have a cup of coffee or a beer or dinner with someone who was in the other party. So fast forward through Carter, Reagan, Bush, 41, Clinton, and the early 90s with what's called now the Gingrich Revolution. Mm-hmm. And I don't put it all on the shoulders of Newt Gingrich, but in my mind, there was an inflection point when he and his Republican colleagues in the House came out with a Contract for America. And it was essentially a statement of principles that was just, it was against everything Bill Clinton believed in and was trying to do, and saying everything he's doing is wrong, that's over there, we're over here. And it fostered this notion that they were enemy camps, that there was no way that they were going to work together on an issue. So, you know, that was the 90s. Along comes the election in 2000, when the country was divided and everybody had a different opinion about who won the election. The Supreme Court decided it for us. And then Barack Obama is elected in 2008. And there is a huge blowback from the Republican Party, many of them saying Barack Obama doesn't deserve to be president. Some of them saying he wasn't born in the United States. I mean, you all remember that period. There was a, mm-hmm. And then, you know, we descend, frankly, from there, from 2008, into a time where the Tea Party comes along. There are demonstrations. There are people battling and saying Washington is on the take. You're trying to take away our freedoms. And from that, is born, if you will, the message from Donald Trump, who emerged in 2015 with a message that Washington is on the take, that I'm here to save you, and I'm going to save the country. And so I don't put it all on the shoulders of Donald Trump or all on the shoulders of Newt Gingrich. But I would say that, and it's not that the Democrats are devoid of any responsibility. They've certainly moved to the left at the same time Democrats or Republicans have moved to the right. Let me just add this, Ben. When we went in early last year to begin our series reporting on where did this division come from, the researchers, the amazing experts at the Pew Research Center, showed me all the charts they've done going back decades, and they said if Americans were here, we're this far apart on issues in the early 90s, we are now this far apart. Mm-hmm. And so we have clearly moved farther apart in our attitudes. But they said on top of that, what we think about people in the other party has grown much darker than what it was. And he said 30 years ago, you would ask some Democrats, what do you think about Republicans? And they might have a negative. But he said 8 years ago, 2016, you ask Republicans what they thought about Democrats. 38-40% said they thought Democrats were immoral or dishonest. Today, it's 72%. It's doubled, tripled in some when you ask them, Democrats are dishonest, immoral, and the list goes on. There's been an equal rise in negative feelings on the part of Democrats about Republicans, not quite as much as on the Republican side, but it's a reminder that we are in a place where we are categorizing each other. We're putting each other in boxes that it's harder to get to climb out of, and that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Your incredibly valuable project, America at a Crossroads, demonstrates very clearly, it did prior to the Iowa caucuses. In fact, this was last summer, and if anybody would just like to enjoy the evening or enjoy some excellent viewing, it's all available online without annoying ads, by the way, to go to America at a Crossroads and see some of these episodes here. I'm going back to one that you may recall from last summer when you talked with the Republican strategist and pollster Sarah Longwell, and you know which one I'm talking about because you talked to Iowa Republicans who had voted for Trump twice. And exactly what you're saying, I mean, I noted some quotes from those things, feels like a little like a civil war, a national divorce. Whose fault? The media, social media. And they're saying, I think I'm smart enough to know when I'm being manipulated. I don't think you can be a liberal or a progressive and also be a real Christian.
That, to me, was the hardest thing to hear.
That statement right there.
Was the hardest thing.
Why?
Of that conversation to hear. Sarah Longwell, who was moderating these focus groups for us, she moderated two groups of eight individuals, all of whom were two-time Trump voters. And by the way, we did a focus group a month after that in Pennsylvania with two groups of two-time Democratic voters, Hillary Clinton in 2016 and Biden in 2020, asking them similar but contrasting questions. But when she asked the group of Iowa Republicans who had voted for Trump twice, the first group, we broke them up into two groups. At my request, I gave her a list of questions I wanted. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions was, do you believe it's possible? She was already asking them questions like, what would you think if your son or daughter married a Democrat?
Right.
One woman said, my daughter did. It didn't turn out well. and she went on to say, we're estranged. So it sounded pretty serious.
Yeah.
There were others in the group who said, one man very sweetly said, both of my daughters are very liberal. They're adults. And he said, we love each other. They think I'm wrong to support Donald Trump. I think they're wrong to support the things that they do. So that was, there was some nuance there. To a person, this first group of voters, when Sarah Longwell asked them, do you think it's possible to be a Democrat and to be a person of deep faith, to be a believing Christian?
Mm-hmm.
They all said no. And when she asked why, they said, because we don't believe it's possible to believe that abortion is all right under any circumstance or whatever set of circumstances. And they raised the transgender issue. They said, we believe that Jesus, and I'm quoting one of them, and not exactly, but this is the gist of it, we don't believe that Jesus, that God knows when you're born whether you're male or female, and you can't change that. And so I respect people's right to have religious beliefs, and I think these views were connected to their faith. And I respect that, but it shocked me, I guess, because I didn't want to think that we were that far apart as Democrats and Republicans.
And also brought out in this interview, the party of law and order has a deep distrust of the FBI and the Justice Department, and think that January 6th was, according to these interviews, a setup to sort of entrap the then-president, Donald Trump.
That's right. That was the view that was what they expressed, that January 6th was set up. And all the legal ramifications from that have been part of the deep state trying to go after.
And we've all lived that, those of us here in this auditorium here at Hancher in Iowa City. And I want to ask you to your point of sort of self-segregation, that we don't talk about these things, when that may be the remedy that you will point us to. Applaud if you avoid talking politics unless you know you are in a group of like-minded people. That's America.
It is, and this goes
sad
several years where people report that they cannot go to Thanksgiving dinner with extended family or maybe their own close family because it'll be so uncomfortable. They have to be so careful about what they talk about. We 2 weeks ago, I flew to Colorado to interview a couple. It was part of a report we were doing, part of this Crossroads series, an effort to understand what our political division has done to personal relationships, to marriage, frankly, to dating in America. And both it's had an effect on both. We interviewed a couple. The husband is two-time. He's voted for Trump twice. He plans to vote for him again. The wife works for a labor union in Pueblo, Colorado. She's very liberal. They've been married, I guess, 10 years, and they were, they were kind of charming about it. They said, we disagree, we have vigorous arguments. They said, sometimes it gets so heated that we just have to get up and leave the room, but we try to make up at least within a few hours or by the next morning if we have an argument. It was sweet. But, I mean, the reality is, according to the people who measure marriage in America and who marries who, this already small percentage of Americans, Democrats married to Republicans, and I think it's like 8% or something, 8-10%, has gone down to 3-4% in the last few years because of, and they believe in large part because of politics. We interviewed a group of women who started a Facebook group after the 2016 election. They were women who were married to husbands who were Trump supporters, and they call themselves Wives of the Deplorables.
Yeah.
True story. And I was able to talk to them on a Zoom call. Many of them didn't, of course, don't want to participate because they don't want their identity known, and they only gave us their first names, which we respected. But some of what came through, I was laughing too, but was the pain in these marriages. I mean, this is a really difficult thing that they've, and several of them said, most of them said, they didn't realize before 2016 how much division there was between themselves and their husbands. They didn't realize that there was that fundamental a disagreement over something, over politics and over an issue. The final thing I'll mention is that our younger generation today, and this is again the result of what all the polls are showing, young women are gradually becoming more liberal in their view. Not all of them, but many are. Young men are becoming more conservative. So there is a bifurcating going on.
Why should that be?
You tell me. I mean, I don't understand it. We simply talked to the experts, we reported the polls, but it's so serious a phenomenon that a young man who worked in the Trump White House started a dating app called The Right Stuff because young men were having a difficult time. They said they would go out with a young woman, but as soon as the young woman found out that he was a Trump supporter or voted for Trump, they didn't want to go out with him again. And so they created a dating app so they could find conservatives. But the serious part of that is we talked to a gentleman who studies marriage. He's a sociologist. He's at the University of Virginia, and he said if you look through history, marriage has been a stabilizing force in our society. It has been one of the mechanisms we have for resolving different points of view. And if people get to the point where they are only marrying people who absolutely agree with them on every political issue, he said, you don't have the experience of talking to someone who disagrees with you, who has a different perspective. He said, we shouldn't be going into our corners and only associating with people if you're liberal who are very liberal, or if you're conservative, we need to be mixing a little bit and having those hard conversations. He said that's those marriages, he said, are what's making is what's made our society strong, which I thought was an interesting.
Right. And you may or may not know this, but was it last year, and audience members will remember it because I'm sure there are a number of them who are here, we had James Carville. And Mary Madeline here. They have
good
sort of
friends.
made a show of the division that you just talked about. Yeah. It was entertaining. I don't know.
But they've stayed married.
They've stayed married. Yeah. And they're both...
My husband does a weekly podcast with James Carville. So he gets to enjoy James... I don't know how colorful his language was.
He wore an LSU ball cap the whole time. Is this...
He's a piece of work. We adore him and Mary. They're great.
Large numbers of both Democrats and Republicans say our democracy is under threat, but for different reasons. How do you see the threat to our democracy?
Well, I don't pretend to be a constitutional expert. I didn't study the law. I have so much respect for those who did. But what I can say is reporting on the concerns of those, including Judge Michael Luttig. He's now a retired federal judge, who was one of the most conservative appellate judges on the I can't remember which circuit he was on. One of you can help me, Judge Luttig. In any event, he after he retired from the, or I should say before he retired from the bench, he was under serious consideration for appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court by Republican presidents. He now is one of the foremost voices in public as a retired judge saying that former President Trump would present a serious threat to democracy. And he hangs his argument largely on what happened on January the 6th. On the other hand, as you say, there are Democrats, I mean, there are Republicans who say the democracy is going to be deeply wounded if Joe Biden is reelected.
Because it's all rigged.
Because it's rigged, because there's a, quote, deep state, so on. So yes, you're right. Both sides are making that case. I'm a reporter. I'm trying to come at it from the standpoint of wanting to hear what both sides say. I think we need to listen hard to what people who understand the Constitution are saying, who understand, who've studied our democracy, who've studied our history are saying. So I think it's critical that we listen to that.
After a short break, more of my conversation with Judy Woodruff. It was recorded at Hampshire Auditorium this past Tuesday evening, March 19th. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from IPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from IPR News, and today a special edition of our program highlights from a conversation I had with journalist Judy Woodruff on stage this past Tuesday evening at Hampshire Auditorium in Iowa City, where hundreds were in attendance. At this point, Judy Woodruff talked about how she deals with interviewees who respond with mistruths and lies.
Ben, I wish I had a good answer for you. This is something that we've wrestled with over the last number of years, and it's something that I never thought I was going to have to worry so much about as a reporter, that I was going to be interviewing a public figure and they were going to be saying one thing after another that's demonstrably not borne out by facts. And so
you avoided the word lie there.
Well, I mean, as it's been pointed out to me, and I do believe this, that in order to say someone is lying, and
yes,
I do think it fits in certainly in a number of circumstances, you need to know that that person knows what they're saying is false, that they are deliberately making it up. And so when you've gotten to that point, I think if you're confident that they're making it up, they know it's not true. But of course, there are some who will say, well, how do you know that that person doesn't believe what they're saying is true, and so, or isn't true, or is true? So there's some mind games going on here, but in all seriousness, it's been one of the hardest things that I've had to deal with as a reporter. If you're doing a 6 or 7 minute interview with someone and they're making one statement after another,
right,
that is, as you say, not borne out by the facts, do you spend the entire interview, in essence, quote, correcting them, or do you say, what is your view of that? And do you say, okay, I understand that there's another side to that story, but then you move on to the next question? I'm giving you a totally unsatisfactory answer because I haven't figured it out. I have not figured it out. I'd like to tell you, because I've had, you know, some people have come to me and said, oh, well, you just need to correct them. You just interrupt them and don't let them say anything. But that the point of doing one of these interviews, and we believe this at the NewsHour deeply, is to let people give you their view. Let them say what they believe, even if it's not borne out by facts. Challenge them on it. Mm-hmm. Definitely challenge them on it, but don't prevent them from saying what they want to say. We're not gonna get to the point, I hope, where we say we just don't want to hear your point of view. What we should be saying is we want to hear it, but we're gonna challenge it if it is not.
There are some
to facts
where, like you would on the NewsHour, no longer invite a climate science denier on, right?
That's correct.
I mean, there it is.
Where that's correct.
It is clearly crossed the line.
I mean, yeah. I mean, people who the Earth is flat. you know, Barack Obama was born in Kenya. I mean, so much of what we're seeing in our political discourse now is. It is a matter of, okay, are you going to look at the story from this side or that side? They can take the same set of statistics, and one side looks at it from here, and one side looks at it from there, whether it's immigration, how many people are coming across the border, how much authority does the president have, what more should the Border Patrol be doing, how much authority can the president be given in this compromise legislation that was, you know, went to the Senate. After, and then back to the house, and then after the Republicans said they were looking for compromise and said no, we can't vote for this. Both sides were describing the exact same thing in completely different ways. As media, I mean, as reporters, we ask them the question, we challenge them with what the other side says, but in the end, it's up to the public to make up their minds. It's not up to us to tell you how to vote. It's not up to us to tell you what to think, but it is up to us to try to illuminate and shine a light on who is saying what and whether that holds up, you know, stands the test of verity, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Judy, this person in the audience would like to know who you would like to interview that you haven't had the opportunity to quite yet.
Well, Pope Francis, I would like to sit down with him.
Really?
Yep. I have not. And? I would. I would like to talk to him. I would be interested in interviewing President Xi of China. I mean, there are, goodness, I mean, I guess there are some obvious ones. Vladimir Putin, I don't know. I mean, what kind of a, you know, is he going to answer questions?
What about historical figures? Let's make that impossible.
Oh, my goodness. Historical figures. That Martin Luther King, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Franklin Roosevelt. Abraham Lincoln. Yes. George Washington, our greatest presidents. Thomas Jefferson. I'd love to go back. Bring them back and we'll be able to sit down and just have a conversation.
We'll see if the Levitt family can arrange that.
I'll be here.
This person wants to know your thoughts on the future for a third party. This is a question I'm sure you get a lot, and I get a lot. We had a newsroom conversation about this just the other day. Again, why does our country have to have just two parties? A lot of people, and this election is polling shows us that many, many Americans of both parties would love not to have just these two choices. Why do we have that? Why not a third party? Why hasn't it been successful? You've covered, independent candidates going back to, how many remember the name?
John Anderson in
1980.
And Ross Perot in 1992. So
right.
Independent candidates have made a difference. I mean, the Bush people are forever, the George H.W. Bush family was forever ungrateful, felt ungrateful toward Ross Perot, fellow Texan. Well,
Clinton would not have been elected.
Because of what happened in 1992.
He would not have been elected, right?
Well, I don't know about the math, but they believe that Ross Perot cost in the election.
Split the vote there.
It's what the founding fathers set up our system of government, and over the last 200 and how many years, we have a winner in so many parts of our country. It's a winner-take-all process. The system that we have now is tailored to make the two sides stronger and to reward only going to your side and to punish those who go to the middle and compromise.
What can the news media, you as a member of the news media, do to fight this system of polar extremes being reported on again and again and again?
One of the things we're doing, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to Alaska to report on their primary, on their reform of their primary system. They've come up with a type of ranked choice voting. They're calling it, I think, top four, where they, you all are familiar because you've had a lot of debate here in Iowa about this. They went to this system in the last election, and it got a lot of attention. We're going up there to look at sort of the aftermath of it and how people feel about it. It takes some of the party power away from the Republicans and the Democrats, and that has the effect of diminishing the power of the parties. It sounds kind of convoluted the way I'm not explaining it as well as others do, but the point of it is that it is to departisanize, or is that a word, departisan? eyes are politics.
Age is on the minds of a number of our audience members. We've never had presumptive major party presidential candidates as old as Biden, 81 years old. I'm sounding older than I am actually right now. And Donald Trump, 77. It's fair to say both candidates have shown their age in certain instances. Biden confusing the president of Mexico with the president of Egypt. Trump confusing Nikki Haley with Nancy Pelosi when talking about January 6th. And yet polls show there's more concern about Biden's age than Trump's. What are your thoughts about the age factor in this race and how it's being covered, rightly or wrongly?
Well, it's unavoidable. I mean, we have our oldest president ever, who would be, if he's reelected, 86 when he left office. He'd be 82 if he's elected president. So it's understandably a subject of discussion. Donald Trump is only 4 years behind. If he's elected, he would be, 80-something when he left office. I have to go back to that. Ronald Reagan was in his 60s, and that was considered very old. I remember when he ran, the Democrats said, oh, he's way too old to be president. People are living longer. We all know people who live into their 90s and over 100.
You are the guest of a state that has the oldest sitting U.S. senator, 90 years old, Charles Grassley.
Okay, I was going to let you point that out, but okay. And there are other members of the Senate who have served well into their 80s and even crossing the 90 threshold. So we are living longer. It's happening before our eyes. It is inevitably an issue. I think in the case of President Biden, when you see President Biden in person, his mental acuity is every bit what it was, his verbal acuity what it was, but on television what comes across is somewhat harder. It's harder for him. Perhaps that's because of the lights. I noticed that he squints in mm-hmm. the lights, and some of that is teleprompter. Some of that may be because they are shining a light right in his face. He walks more stiffly than he used to. I guess he's acknowledged that he's had back problems. He's released his medical report completely. I mean, he's given us more detail than we want to know from his doctors. We do not have an equivalent medical report, I would point out, from former President Trump. I don't know why he's made that decision. They put out a report, but it's not the full report that Biden has put out. So my answer is, people are going to take it into consideration. They are taking it into consideration. In the end, is that going to be the only thing that people vote on? No, I think there are going to be a number of things that come to play.
In 2013, you and Gwen Ifill were named the co-anchors of the PBS NewsHour. That was the first time that an American national news broadcast was anchored by two women. This audience member wants you to share a story, funny or serious, about your time working with Gwen Ifill. I'm sure you miss her terribly. We had tears in our eyes when we saw the entire episode of the NewsHour dedicated to her memory.
The night she passed.
Yeah.
Such an incredible, deep, deep loss for the NewsHour family, and not only for the NewsHour family, but for the country. For me, coming back to the NewsHour when I did in 2006, where Gwen was by then a prominent figure, I was so fortunate because we were already friends, and then we were colleagues. And then several years later, when Jim Lehrer announced that he was stepping down, that he was retiring as anchor, they came to Gwen and me. But here's an anecdote to share with you. If you think about it, when two guys are sitting at an anchor desk together as co-anchors, you don't think they're both wearing a coat and tie. They're wearing a nice white shirt or a blue shirt and a red tie or a blue tie or a yellow tie. When two women sit next to each other, they cannot wear the same color. It would look like the Bobbsey twins. And so Gwen and I decided, okay, we can't show up at work both wearing red, both wearing green, blue, purple, whatever. So we had to come up with a system. We came up with a system where we would email each other, okay, this week I'm wearing red, yellow, blue, green, black, you know. And the other person, and it would be my turn, and I would send Gwen, and then the next week it was her turn. And but it was only a matter of months before we figured out we knew each other's wardrobe so well. We stopped having to send these notes. We just intuited what the other person was going to wear. There was one day in all the years we anchored together when we showed up, we both showed up in purple. And I said to Gwen, you know, we ought to just go on the set and say, you know, we're twins. And she said, no, I'm going to go home. I think, you know, and she was right because it draws your eye away from where it's supposed to be. But that's who Gwen was. I was the luckiest person in the world to get to sit not just beside her on the set, but to be her friend and to learn from her, her fearlessness, her love of journalism, her just sort of unerring eye of, you know, for what's news and what's important. We were all blessed to have her with us as long as she was. She went way too young.
Can you share what brings you hope in this political moment?
I believe that despite all the noise and the fighting and the anger and the language that we are hearing from the far left, the far right, and from the far left, and from some of our political leaders, despite all that, I don't think that's what the middle of America wants. I think what most Americans want is a return to civil discourse. I don't think we're talking about, yes, I think that's what people want. It's not American to hate other people. It's we should have these debates, but we don't need to hate each other. And we also the one thing I would add to that is that compromise is not a dirty word. We cannot work our way through our toughest problems in this country, whether it's government spending, immigration, climate change, business regulation. If the middle is hated, if the middle is considered out of the picture, we have to find ways to work together. That's where I'm coming from.
Judy, we've had a wonderful evening with you. I wanted to circle back here at the finish to just recognize the pioneering work you've done in journalism and for women in journalism with Gwen and with others. We should mention you were also the founding co-chair of the International Women's Media Foundation, an organization dedicated to promoting and encouraging women in communication industries worldwide. And with this in mind, I have a little gift for you. Oh, yes, it is right here. Because you referenced her before.
Oh, this is Caitlin in there?
Caitlin, are
is
you
Caitlin
in there?
In there?
Well, you can see what's in there. And if you would be so kind as to hold it up high once you unpack it, trust us.
My goodness.
Do you have one of these?
This is exciting. No, I do not. This is exciting.
At this point in the conversation, I brought out a little thank you gift for Judy, her own Caitlin Clark jersey.
Tell us, how many step back three pointers have you made in your lifetime? Zero? Judy Woodruff, thank you so much.
Highlights from a conversation earlier this week with Judy Woodruff at Hancher Auditorium in Iowa City. By the way, you can see photos from the event, including Judy beaming with her Caitlin Clark jersey, at our website, ipr.org. Just search for the River to River podcast. What a pleasure for IPR to be asked once again by the University of Iowa College of Law to be a partner in this discussion as part of their Levitt Lecture Series. Today's program was edited by Danny Gear. Also thanks to Caitlin Troutman. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.